Well, thank you for inviting me to this really nice church and to come here early in the morning to learn about an important topic. I mean, if it's not important to you, you can be sure it's important to your children and your grandchildren. And let's face it, what the kids will normally hear about dinosaurs is millions of years, the Bible's wrong. You can't escape that. So just so you know where I'm coming from, I am a scientist who believes the Bible. I'll tell you more about myself in the main service. Pardon me. Sorry. Got antiseptic? Oh, good antiseptic thing under here. Good. That'll be necessary here. Okay. Just to talk about what I... where was I? I'm sorry. Yeah, of course, dinosaurs are often associated with this man here, who you might say is a patron saint of the religion of the government schools in the West. And that's what our ministry is basically dedicated to countering. But we are Bible first. We put the Bible first, and therefore we are pointing to Jesus Christ as Creator and Savior. That's the aim of our ministry. And refuting the evolution is designed to undercut the main argument that's being used against Christianity today. And one place you can find out about more of us is our website. It looks like you're taking notes. So our website is creation.com. Do you remember that? And it has about 13,000 articles on it, and they cover two basic topics: is creation true, and does it matter? In fact, one way you can be connected to our website is by signing up to our free email newsletter, and it tells you about classic articles in the archives, articles coming up very soon, covering topics in the culture, what you might have read in the newspaper, and also creation speak in the area. So we have this email newsletter we've had for some time now, called the InfoBytes, and if you want to sign up, we have this sign-up sheet coming. Going to come around, put your name and your email. We promise not to sell or give your address away to a third party. You won't be get unwelcome emails. We will protect your privacy, and we will not spam you. And you may have also seen some of the books we have here. The reason we have these books and videos is that we know that people aren't going to remember everything they're going to learn in a Sunday school hour. Thank you for that, Mr. Chris. Thank you. And that's why we have the books to help reinforce what you learn, as well as to take it to other people as well. One of them you might like is called the Genesis Account. It's my commentary on Genesis 1 to 11. And it's one of the only commentary in the world that covers dinosaurs. It also covers why Genesis matters for the Christian faith, and also how Jesus and the apostles understood Genesis, which is a very, very relevant thing, which I'll be talking about in the main service. And one of the mottos of our group is be ready to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that is in you. We're supposed to have reasons and answers for what we believe. Christianity is not a blind faith. We're supposed to be able to defend it. And let's face it, what happens? Kids come home and they get questions like, well, God made everything, who made God? And didn't dinosaurs die out millions of years ago? And what about carbon dating? All these sort of things. And they're answered in this book here. Creation Answers book has a number of the topics that people always ask in Q&A times. And I will have some time for questions at the end of this. I'll try to give you guys a chance to ask me questions about creation, evolution. So first of all, let's get our starting point right. So you see, the Bible is the Word of God. It's a true history of the universe. The Bible is foundationally a book of God's history. And the theology and morality of the Bible depends on the history of the Bible. You can't separate the two. And so what does the Bible say about dinosaurs? Well, it tells us. You may not believe it, but it actually tells us when dinosaurs existed. Because it tells us that on day 6 of creation week, God made the beasts of the earth according to their kind. Dinosaurs are beasts. And notice 10 times in Genesis 1 it says that things reproduce after their kinds. It's not one kind evolving into different kinds. It's separate kinds, lots of variation within the kinds, but not one kind turning into another. Now, what else did God create on day 6? human beings. And as we learn in Genesis 1, where we read that God made them male and female in his image, gave them dominion over the rest of creation. In Genesis 2, we read it's only Adam and Eve that were created on day 6. But the point about this is, though, if you use logic, it showed that dinosaurs and humans must have lived at the same time, which is a very surprising conclusion for many people. But this is what the God's Word teaches. And the thing is, people might ask you, okay, why don't we find humans and dinosaur fossils together? Well, the answer to that is to go behind that question. What's the assumption behind such a question? The assumption is, if things live together, then they will be fossilized together. But is this the correct assumption? Well, let's look at an example here. In the foreground, we have a fish called the coelacanth. And they believe that died out with the dinosaurs millions of years ago. But of course, we know coelacanths are alive and well today. And in the background is a whale flipper. Now, whales and coelacanths live in the sea now together. We know that. We've got them. But they are not found fossilized together. So just because things live together, it doesn't guarantee they will be fossilized together. Because the fossil record is not a sequence of age as such, it's a sequence of burial. And most of the burial will be by the flood of Noah's day. Now, there's no question that dinosaurs were part of the victims of the flood. Now, first of all, let's define what I mean by dinosaur. So it comes from originally Greek via Latin, meaning terrible lizard. And one feature of a dinosaur is they had these column-like legs. You see how the thigh bone is straight up and it has this horizontal projection into the hip bone so it could swivel in the vertical direction. That's what a dinosaur is. It has that sort of structure of the leg. Now, crocodiles and lizards, the reptiles living today, have a completely different leg structure. So it's not right to call a crocodile a dinosaur. The legs are very, very different. That's one of the definitions of the dinosaur, having that column-like leg structure. Now, certainly they existed. We find the bones, and some of them are huge creatures like this creature here. See how huge the leg must have been, not even up to the knee. It's a huge creature. And sometimes you have almost complete skeletons like this Brachiosaurus, and the word means arm lizard because the forearms are very long here. And this could well be the heaviest dinosaur known from a complete skeleton. And see, here's a comparison, though. See, the Brachiosaurus is like a giant version of a giraffe, but far bigger, far heavier, bulkier. But the blue whale was bigger than all of them. See, the blue whale is still the biggest creature, the biggest animal that ever existed, to our knowledge. Oh, here's another view of the Brachiosaurus. Now, there are some things that we know were designed in these dinosaurs. Some things we just don't know enough about because we haven't got the soft parts to tell us. But we know they must have had some incredible designs. Like, consider a giraffe. It's much taller than us. Question, how does the heart pump the blood up to the head? A lot of work to do. It has a very powerful heart. It has a blood pressure of about 300 over 180. I'm not sure if you know these blood pressure numbers, what they mean. But a healthy blood pressure in humans is 120 over 80. And if you have a blood pressure of 180, you should go to the hospital. It's a hypertensive emergency. But a giraffe needs that high pressure to get the blood up there. But what happens when the giraffe bends to drink? Why doesn't it blow its brains out? Why don't it have a massive hemorrhagic stroke, you see? The reason is that there's some shunting blood vessels to divert the pressure so it doesn't blow its brains out. Okay? And also, its legs basically have pressure bandages to make sure the blood gets back up to the heart from the legs, you see? So the pressure bandages, the shunting things. So a lot of things required for a giraffe. And so we just only could wonder what would have been required for a Brachiosaurus to get the blood up far higher, blood pressure of about 600 to 700, that's what you need. And what sort of powerful heart must have been needed to pump the blood up to that height, and also what mechanism to stop the getting a stroke when he bent down. I mean, all these sort of things, we just don't know because we haven't got the information. We have only got the hard parts. There's some things that we can tell from the bones, though. You see the general type of dinosaur called the sauropod, the long neck and long straw. Now, this is not a brachiosaurus, because look here, his thigh bones, his leg bones, hind legs are bigger. So he's got a more horizontal posture. You notice there's an arch shape there? Now, the arch, we can tell, that's a good engineering design, because we have lots of bridges made in arches, windows made of arches. You see what we've got here, the bridge, the arch provides the strength, that's an engineering principle, and the cables hold the weight of it, but the arch is what's providing the strength, you see. So you can see the comparison here, there's an arch in all these big dinosaurs, and the ribs are holding up the belly there. So again, that's some engineering design we can tell from the bones. Now, the question then is, I'm sure kids want to know, what's the biggest dinosaur of all? But that's a hard question to answer, really, because some of the candidates don't have that many bones. That's a problem. You see, here is one of the candidates, the Amphicelius fragilimus, which looks off the scale, right? But the thing is that you have to ask, what was it based on? Here is the reconstruction, the nice pretty picture. What is the evidence for it? Well, let's look at this picture here. The black is the reconstructed outline. The white is the bone they found. You see a problem here. Where are the neck bones, the tail bones, the leg bones, the rib bones? There's nothing there. Just to have one vertebra, part of your spinal column, that's all they found. They made a big reconstruction of that. I think I'm a bit skeptical, to be honest. And a lot of the other big dinosaur candidates are very fragmentary. You see how little bones they have. But when it comes to Diplodocus, say, that seems to be the longest dinosaur from a complete skeleton. We've got most of the bones of that. And so here's a human for scale. Human, we're quite small compared to the biggest dinosaurs. Now, we know that was big because we've got the bones of it. Some of the others, well, it's probably big, but we don't really know because we haven't got the bones. In fact, with the Amphicelius, it's even worse because they found that it's a broken vertebra, not even a complete one. Not even one complete bone of this thing, and the bone's been lost, so we really can't go measure it. It seems, so was there a typo in the report or something? We just, it's too hard to know. Now, when it comes to the biggest dinosaur from a majority of the skeleton, this thing here, the Phutolonchosaurus, it's not a typo. We've got over half the skeleton, but still no legs, no tail. But we've got the enormous neck, we've got the very wide hip bones, about 10 feet wide. This is huge, right? And here's a human, in case you're wondering. You can almost miss the human, can't you? Well, this creature found also in Argentina, called the Dreadnoughtus. But again, since we only have the bones, it's hard to estimate. So the early estimates had it bigger than a 737 Boeing, but the later estimates put it right more down here. See, so that when they estimate from the bones and they're incomplete, they can get things wrong. But it's very important to this one. They said, look, I mean, if you look at the tail, the processes, these are called processes, these things coming out of the tail, they are attachments for powerful muscles. They can tell the muscle had these scars on the bone. They could tell it was a very powerful muscle. So the discoverers said this had a weaponized tail 30 feet long. A weaponized tail. We're trying to remember that. Now, then the question is, why isn't the word dinosaur in the Bible? Well, I think it's important to realize that dinosaur is a very recent word. So you look at the King James first translated in 1611. That's not the first English Bible, by the way. Okay, but 230 years later is when the word dinosaur was invented. So of course the translators are not going to use a word that doesn't exist. It just wouldn't make sense. See, the word computer, I mean, some of you guys might be old enough to remember slide rules and logbooks, maybe, okay? So calculator seems like a very recent word, but in fact, the word calculator is an older word than dinosaur is. Calculator goes back to the Middle Ages. So, of course, the word dinosaur is not going to be there, but there are other words which are quite intriguing, which are there, and would seem to describe things that we later called dinosaurs. Like the book of Job may be the first book of the Bible to be completed, Probably he lived around the time of Abraham. That's the usual consensus, judging by the culture of his time. And you see, in the later chapters of Job, God is talking about all these creatures he'd made, giving him a creation talk, basically. And these animals, we all know these animals, right? These are undisputed real animals. Sorry. Okay, but when it gets to Job chapter 40, we've got this very intriguing creature. See, we've got real animals here, no question, real animals. But then we get to Job 40, what do we find? A behemoth. What is a behemoth? You see, a behemoth is not an English word, it's a Hebrew word. In fact, a behemot would be how you say it in Hebrew. Behemot is a plural term. The ot ending is a plural. Behemah is the singular. One behemah, two behemot. But it's only one creature. Why has it got a plural? Because it's saying this is the beast of beasts. Behemah is beast. Behemoth is the beast of beasts. See, there's a plural of intensity, they call that. So he say, here is the beast of beasts. God, Job was supposed to know what it was. I mean, God was educating Job. So Job, you had to know what it was. He, the plant eater. A very intriguing picture here. We have a tail like a cedar. Now, in the Bible, the comparison with cedar, the cedar is the biggest tree in the Middle East. Solomon built his temple out of them. So if God is comparing something to a cedar, he's trying to say how massive it is. Here is a cedar log for you. And there are cedars much bigger than this. Okay, so this is a tail like a cedar. So a tail that looks like this. Okay, now some study Bibles say, well, maybe this behemoth was a hippopotamus or an elephant. Let's try elephant. Does this have a tail like a cedar? No, not unless it's a bonsai cedar, okay? Now, what about a hippo? No, this doesn't make any sense. I've got a better idea. Now, remember that dreadnought I showed you with the weaponized tail here? Now, wouldn't that be a perfect thing to compare to a cedar tree? A tail like a cedar, a tail like this sort of thing, weaponized, powerful, 30 feet long tail. That makes far more sense of the description of the behemoth than a hippo or an elephant does. Okay, another thing, people talked about dragons, and this is an interesting carving, and we've got a whole book about those sorts of things. This looks like a stegosaur to me, don't you think? I mean, no animal today has these very distinctive plates on the back. And that was clearly carved by someone who saw a real thing. I mean, the fossils, you couldn't tell that the plates were stuck up. In fact, when they first named the stegosaurus, it means roofless. They thought the plates were flat down, protecting the back. Only later did they realize it had to be vertical. And then think about the dragons of old. A lot of cultures have legends of humans eventually encountering these creatures called dragons and eventually destroying them. And the Chinese calendar has animals. And again, we have 11 animals. And the dragon. I mean, the dragon seems to be just as real an animal as all the others. There's nothing special about the dragon in the Chinese calendar. So that means when they drew up the calendar thousands of years ago, it means the dragon, presumably, it was just another animal they knew about. See, it's interesting in Chinese, the word for dragon is long, and the word for dinosaur is kong long, which means terrible dragon. That's in modern Chinese. And there's another one of these. So a lot of these different things. Humans clearly must have seen dinosaurs to carve things like that. And we've got a book here called Dire Dragons, a coffee table book, which documents a lot of these carvings and statues around the world, and then compares them with the best reconstructions, evolutionary reconstructions of dinosaurs. And that seems to be the model of these, what these people did. Okay, now, what happened to them? Why do we find the fossils? Well, let's look at that. You see, when you look at the fossil record, it's quite interesting. How do you get a fossil, though? Have you seen fossil roadkill? Now, why do you think you haven't seen fossil roadkill? What happens to the roadkill? It gets eaten. It's not going to last. It rots. It gets eaten, you see. So when you find a fossil, it means you've had to have preserved it before it disintegrated, right? But then you find things like this. You see how fast this thing must have been preserved. It must be incredibly fast to preserve these dinosaurs in the middle of the flight. I see one young man was having a velociraptor on his shirt. Well, this is a velociraptor as a fossil. This is a velociraptor fossil fighting with a protoceratops in the middle of his fight. See, it must have been buried really fast. And this is, again, consistent with what the global flood of Noah's day would do. It would bury things really, really fast like this. Another thing, you go to some of long-necked creatures, and they all have this neck-thrown back posture. It's a really weird posture. Why would they have that? Well, the answer is, I mean, think about the muscle work of holding out something. If you try to hold out a weight like this, it's quite hard to do. The leverage is against you, right? You need a powerful torque to hold it like that. So think of a long neck. What do you have to do? The muscles will get worn out. So what they have instead is an elastic ligament to hold most of the weight for you, okay? So the muscle isn't working so hard. So the elastic ligament down the neck and tail, it's not quite strong enough. The muscles have to do some work, but not that much of it. But after death, the muscles don't work anymore, so you wouldn't expect that the neck should flop, right? Okay. But if the neck was somehow buoyant, the buoyant liquid would take most of the weight, and then the ligament would be powerful enough to pull the neck back, you see. So now the consensus among secular sciences is that these things must have been submerged in water around the time of death to produce that backwards neck, which is very common. They even call this the dead dinosaur pose, this neck thrown back posture. Like that. It's really quite intriguing. All around the world, these necks thrown back. And this is very good evidence they were in water when they died, which is again consistent with what the flood would produce. Now, what about dinosaur footprints? We do find them, but okay, think about this. If you left a footprint outside, how long would the footprint last? Millions of years? A week? You'd be pushing it, wouldn't you? You see, but so the thing is, why do we have footprints still existing? The thing is, they were under a rock layer, so they had to the layer of the footprint and the top layer. They had to remove tons and tons of the top layer to expose the footprints. That's what they had to do to expose these 3,000 footprints in Queensland, Australia, my home state. Now, but as soon as they exposed the footprints, they started to wear out. They wore away. So they built a protective shed over it, a sheltering roof, but that wasn't enough. They still started to wear away. So now they've got a conservation building that protects it from temperature. It controls the temperature, controls humidity. It stops water running over them, stops animals running over them, stops humans running over them. So very delicate. So you've got this conservation building protecting these footprints from being worn away. And here's a conservation building from outside. See how delicate these footprints have to be? So then the question is, evolutionary geologists say the top layer was millions of years after the bottom layer. How could this be? How could the footprints have survived for millions of years before being buried? When we know how fragile they are. Now, the answer is, almost as soon as they were made, the next layer came in and cemented them in place and preserve them. Another very interesting thing that they realize is, I think you've got this movie in your library, worth seeing, that you have, in almost every case, you have footprints first, and under the millions of years view, you have the creature that made them millions of years after the footprints they made. Hang on, do things live millions of years? No, it doesn't make sense. That's a problem. what we see instead is there can't be any time between when someone leaves a track and when someone's buried. But the point is, why is there a difference in the layer? It's because the dinosaurs are probably fleeing from this flood, doing the best they can, leaving the footprints. Next layer comes and buries them, and eventually the flood catches up with the dinosaur itself on a higher level. So when you have this flood, it's going to bury the footprints before it buries the creature. But the millions of years view makes no sense of this. Now, another good evidence is finding soft tissues in dinosaur bones, which again was a humongous surprise for people, finding soft tissues. Shouldn't be there. I'll let the discoverer, Dr. Mary Schweitzer, speak for herself on the 60 Minutes show.
What happened next happened by mistake. Mary put some fragments of the bone in acid to dissolve away the outermost layer of mineral. But the acid worked too fast, and all the mineral dissolved away. Being a fossil, there should have been nothing left. But there was. And it was elastic, like linen tissue.
Then did we see?
No. She shot a video she took under the microscope.
That's really what happened? Yes. That's the dinosaur without mineral. That's what was left.
It looked like the soft tissue she would have expected to find if it had been modern bone. This was impossible. This bone was 68 million years old.
So you see this, and you think, what?
You didn't want to tell anybody.
Then you'd be ridiculed,
yes.
Right?
And so I said to my technician, okay, do it again. I don't believe it.
And yet, in sample after sample, they were there. Things that look suspiciously like flexible, transparent blood vessels. She finally mustered the courage to tell Jack.
That she saw the phone away and there were blood vessels. And, you know, I was like shocked. How could that be? That's right.
The things Mary was finding inside dinosaur bones, blood vessels, and even what seemed to be intact shells, pose a radical challenge to the existing rules of science. That organic material can't possibly survive even a million years, let alone 68 million.
Now you see the bias here though, right? I mean, they admit that the laws of science say these things couldn't be even a million years old. That's the laws of science. Science says they can't be millions of years old, but they want to stick to their belief system of 68 million years for the death of a dinosaur. But they're going against the actual objective science here. The actual science supports the biblical timescale. Then the question must be, what happened to the dinosaurs? Well, the thing is, some of them, if they survived to Job, they survived so people could carve things out of it. Some of them must have survived the flood, and they did it on this boat here. Oh, not this boat. Goodness, please get rid of this one. I hate that boat. Because when you have that picture, you're telling the kids the Ark's a fairy story. Please don't do that. There's no need to, because the Bible tells us how big the Ark was. Yeah, 300 cubits long, that's longer than a football field. You see, here's a cubit, elbow to fingertip. Mine's about 19 inches, I think. Okay, and let's take an 18-inch cubit, a fairly conservative sort of cubit here. Okay, that, well, look, we can reconstruct it. You see, how long was it? See, longer than a football field. How wide was it? It's actually wider than six lanes of the interstate. And as high as a 3 or 4 or 5 story building, that's a pretty big vessel. It's not the silly overgrown bathtub. And there's no reason you can't show kids any child appropriate way of showing the kids how big this thing was. I mean, also, when you drive on the road, you see these trucks here. What do you call these things here? Semi trailers? Yeah, okay. It would take about 340 of those to load up the Ark. Which is about half a mile long, okay? It's a lot of trailers. If Noah had a fleet of these trailers, that would be a huge vessel. It's not a small vessel at all. That's a lot of animals. And each of those trailers, because they've got decks, can carry 300 sheep weighing over 100 pounds each. Okay, that's how much they can carry. So you imagine how much the ark could carry. And the ark was also a very stable vessel. You see, the dimensions make for almost incredible stability. Even in the roughest seas, even a tsunami could not have capsized this. Wave three times bigger than a typical tsunami could not have capsized this. That's how stable a vessel was. It's so wide, it's almost impossible to capsize such a boat. So what did they have to take on board? The kinds of creatures. Now, how many kinds of dinosaur are we talking about, though? That's what people seem to worry about. You see, for instance, there was no marine creatures on board the ark, okay? No dolphins, because dolphins don't need to be rescued from a flood. They're in the sea. They're happy there. There's only marine creatures. And also, the number of kinds is different from the number of species, you see. Even in the cat kind, these guys are all the same created kind. Even though we have different names for them, they come from the same created kind. They can interbreed with each other. So when it comes to dinosaurs, probably there are only about 50 or so kinds, and since dinosaurs weren't clean animals, so 50 pairs of dinosaurs on the ark. Not the hundreds of species that you've heard of, probably 50 or so kinds, 50 or so pairs. Lots of varieties. Now take the sauropods, for instance, the big dinosaurs. See, look at these skulls. They're almost the same sort of creature. I think they're the same creature, don't you think so? But I think they're given different names. See, the Diplodocus might have been a long, skinny version of the Apatosaurus. And also, the Jack Horner, the Jack on that video I showed you, he showed that dinosaurs change shape when they age. It means that they gave different names to babies and young adults to the full-grown specimen. You see, these are all got different names, but he thinks they're the same creature at different stages of growth. In fact, he said about a third of them might be different stages of other known dinosaurs. Now, even the Torosaurus, you see, the Triceratops, a very famous type of dinosaur, it's seen that when it matured, the skull hollowed out, and it became a Torosaurus. It's an interesting thing there. So these are the same creature at different stages of growth. So that's a big problem with trying to sort of try to how many dinosaurs were on the ark, and we actually have to work out what the kinds were. Much fewer than most people think. And also, dinosaurs didn't start off that big. They started off with as eggs. Dinosaurs laid eggs, and the egg just can't be bigger than a football. Okay, so even the biggest dinosaur started off as an itty bitty dinosaur. And the other thing is, God said the animals will come to you. So the idea is that God is bringing the animals to Noah. Noah didn't have to go and fetch them. So God is the one who chooses the specimens on board. Another thing with dinosaurs is they weren't always fully grown. They started off as eggs, but then looking at the growth rings on dinosaurs, what do we find? We find they grew slowly at first. And then they went through this sort of teenage growth spurt, really big growth spurt, and then they leveled off. So instead of taking the dinosaurs when they're fully grown like this, you know, 25, 30 tons, take them on when they're about a 1 ton. So a year later, he goes on board when he's 4 years old, gets off the ark when he's 5 years old, not much bigger, and then he goes through his growth spurt after he gets off the ark. So that's how Noah didn't have to take the biggest dinosaurs on board. They would have taken them before their growth spurt. That's what would have happened. And how do you take care of them? In fact, the Dutch farmers have known how to take care of animals over the European winters. You've got the pot stall. You just put the animals there and just keep on adding straw. It's actually very hygienic and clean, you see. It is very low maintenance, low tech solution. And the straw absorbs the moisture. In fact, it gets the only pong, the stink, is when you actually have to clean it out after winter. But while you're using this, actually it's quite fairly hygienic. And the chrupstal, when you've got a gutter in the middle there for the waste products, and you also have on the other side troughs for mass feeding, the grains, pouring in there, water pouring through there. So you've got these low-tech solutions to take care of lots of animals with very low maintenance. You've got a few things there that could have happened on the ark to keep them all. And a lot of different things if we could think about it. So dinosaurs would have been preserved on the ark. Now, after they came off the ark, I think some of them would have grown very big and been very menacing, and I think humans would have hunted them. I think humans could hunt dinosaurs because they can build traps, for instance. They have weaponry. They can make poison, and fire, of course, is a very big thing for humans that animals just can't cope with. The point is, I think humans would have been the ones to hunt them. In fact, you look at the dragon legends around the world, it ends up with humans killing the dinosaur, the dragon. So I think humans were finally responsible for wiping out the dinosaurs. It's an unusual conclusion, but let's see if the evolutionists have a better idea. See, one of the evolutionary theories is called the junkie theory, where narcotic plants evolved, okay, and the plant eaters got stoned, and the meat eaters had nothing left to eat. And you've got constipation theories, and low roughage plants evolved, like white bread, not much nutritional value, so the plant eaters got stoned, and the meat eaters had nothing left to hunt. And you've got the meteorite theory. The problem is, though, the meteorite would actually wipe out the wrong things. See, crocodiles should have been wiped out by this meteorite, but why are they still alive? Why are lizards? Why are frogs alive? It just seems to wipe out the totally the wrong things, as well as being in the wrong place in the evolutionary scheme of things. Because in the evolutionary story, they believe the dinosaurs most became extinct before the impact of this meteorite under their dating system. So clearly the meteorite couldn't have wiped those dinosaurs out. It's in the wrong time according to their own dating methods. And so the last evolutionary theory I'll talk to you about is this one by Gary Larson. The tobacco evolved, they all died of lung cancer. So let's conclude here. Dinosaurs tell us about God's creativity, all the different created kinds. And they tell us about the fall because, and I'll explain next session, is the fall of Adam and Eve that brought death and suffering into the human and animal kingdom. And the flood. The flood is God's judgment on humanity for their wickedness and violence. And it tells us about God's providence. God provided this amazing, he told Noah the right dimensions to build a very seaworthy vessel to ride out the ark. And we even got a connection with the gospel. Noah was a righteous man. God found righteousness in Noah. And the only way for him to be saved physically was on the ark. The only way for us to be saved spiritually from the second death is through Jesus Christ, the door, way, the truth, and the life. So you've got a connection with the gospel here.